Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. For this episode, we interviewed Zalman Tzipora, a Bundes student and organizer who has been attending university in Berkeley, California, and in past months has been completing a semester in Berlin. This has provided him with an understanding of the specificities of local Palestine solidarity activism in these two distinct contexts.
We met Zalman through our shared participation in the effort to rebuild the International Jewish Labor Bund. This is still in its very early stages, but has already brought together hundreds of people and led to the establishment of several local circles. If you are interested in taking part, check out the link in the description.
Zalman also joined Zach in Krakow, where they helped organize a Jewish bloc for the May Day demonstration in the city. This was a significant effort, as there has not been organized Jewish participation in such a demonstration in Poland in generations.
In our conversation, among many things, including our understanding of Yiddish, we discussed one of the core ideas of Bundism, national cultural autonomy.
Although this was initially formulated by Austrian Marxists as a way to integrate the multi-ethnic Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Bund took this idea and applied it to the Jewish context in a non-territorial manner. In essence, national cultural autonomy provides a framework for minority groups to institutionalize communal self-governance, especially in matters of language and education.
If you'd like to learn more about the Bund in its modern form, check out episode 12, where we interviewed the vice president of the only continuously existing pre-Holocaust branch of the original Jewish Labor Bund.
Thank you so much to our donors. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice. Consider supporting us on Patreon. Every dollar really matters. Follow us on Instagram and share our content with your communities.
And like and subscribe us on YouTube. All the links are in the description. Without further ado, we hope you enjoy the conversation.
Zusammen, die von sie ist great, sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut, a Schwue, a Fleck und Teut.
Zalman, it's great to have you with us. Would you like to introduce yourself?
For sure. Hi, I'm Zalman Tzipora. I use he, they pronouns, or er, zeh, auf Yiddish. I'm an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley, wrapping up my third year. And I'm currently doing a semester abroad at Berlin at Freie Universität. I study history and political science. I especially focus on comparative development of nationalism and political movements in Central and Eastern Europe between 1880s and interwars. And I'm hoping to eventually write a thesis kind of talking about national cultural autonomism, the Bundes concept, and putting that in conversation with later post-colonial ideas about minority nationalism.
That sounds quite familiar, doesn't it, Ben?
Yeah, right. I wrote my master's dissertation on a similar thing, except not really contrasting it with minority nationalism that we see in the decolonial period of the 1950s to 90s, or even today with what we see with Palestine. But instead, I was contrasting it largely with Zionism, which could be considered something like that. Of course, though, it has a bit of a colonial character, so it's very different. And also, I was contrasting it with assimilationist, socialist/communist ideas, which we could see with the Bolsheviks especially. So it's interesting to hear how you're contrasting it with a later concept, because, of course, the Bund's high points was earlier than the 1950s. So it's definitely going to be curious to see where that goes, and we'll want to hear how your ideas around that develop. But as you're really interested in the Bund, I was wondering where that came from for you.
So I started calling myself a Bundist in high school. I was kind of a nerd. I was really into history, and I had just moved into my brother's room after he went off to college with all of his history books. And I was in a model youth and government program arguing with socialists in a group chat. And like any nerd of that age does, I was reading random articles online about Jews in the American labor movement. And I happened to stumble on the name Morris Rosenfeld and the poems that he'd written, in particular, Mein Ruhe Platz. And on a whim, because I heard that his poems were set to music, some of them were songs, I typed that into Spotify. I found Mein Ruhe Platz, and I went down a rabbit hole of Yiddish in the American labor movement, and then Yiddish in the labor movement, and then Jewish socialism, and I found the Bund. And the Bund in particular really struck out to me because I found it at a time when I was starting to question the liberal Zionism that I'd been raised with, but I didn't really have an alternative yet. It was when I was developing my socialist politics and looking at this massive organization that I had never, ever heard about before was just kind of an aha. Oh, this actually makes a lot of sense and articulates everything that I've wanted to say moment. And so I've only kind of gone deeper on that ever since. I got really into organizing, especially as I went to university. I did work with the Young Democratic Socialists of America and Jewish Voice for Peace. I started learning Yiddish at the Steiner Zimmer Program in Amherst, Massachusetts, and I found out about the Bund in Melbourne. It was kind of isolating because at the time I didn't know if there were any other Bundists in the United States, which was a bit of a silly and naive idea. Of course there were. Of course there were other people interested in this, but I had literally never heard it talked about. And so from then on, I was really fascinated by the Bund.
I can relate to that in a real way. I think the way that Bundist ideas are effectively written out from the narratives we learn, whether it's in Jewish day school or Sunday school or whatever, it's not something we're really told. But then you do kind of read about this, you learn about the history of the Bund, and you're like, oh, wait, this is actually more compatible with the values, the Jewish values I was raised with, than Zionism when you actually look at the history. And that for me as well was like a very liberating realization when you're able to find a framework that actually is more holistic and more grounded politically than the cognitive dissonance of liberal Zionism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I was also looking for something that provided an alternative because in the household I was grown in, you know, oh, we hate Bibi, we hate what Israel does. But we've been kicked out of everywhere we've ever lived. We need a state to protect ourselves, very much that narrative. And so I was starting to question that, but I didn't really give it up until I found something that told me, no, actually, you can do this instead and still fight for safety and be interested in Jewish culture.
I'll just make one more point, which is the only other option, really, which is where I went through, is just fully being alienated from your Jewish identities and just kind of going in the more like assimilationist, socialist, or communist angle, where it's like, I don't know how these things can be held at the same time. And then Bundism really does offer that framework to kind of marry your socialism and your Jewishness together in a way that I find very difficult otherwise.
I'm just going to bring this back very quickly, since you mentioned Morris Rosenfeld, because my rabbi locally is a descendant of his and mentioned this to me not too long ago. So shout out to him. Also, fellow history and politics student, although I did ditch the politics after my undergraduate, in my opinion, fully justifiably. I don't like the way politics was taught in my university. But yeah, absolutely. What both of you are talking about, that positive framework, I guess for me, it's something that I was a bit more strongly associated with personally, because in my household, I did know what the Bund was when I was growing up. For me, it was often just something that sounded cool, sounded like it was interesting in the past. But then how do you even sort of begin to adapt it in the modern context, certainly in Poland?
And funnily enough, that's kind of where Zach and I started with our own political organizing together, of trying to translate the history and ideas of Bundism into the modern context, in the student context. I also wanted to mention that you mentioned the role of music and poetry in your journey towards Bundism, and I think that's something that Zach spoke with Ben Rogley about a little bit, and something we do want to speak much more about. For me, Daniel Kahn was a big artist that really helped me understand how to carry this with me. Going to Poland in 2023 with Zach and being surrounded by more Yiddish speakers than I'd ever been, it wasn't something that I'd been able to relate to before that. But then being able to come back to where I was, which was England, and listen to music and continue to engage with that wherever I was something that really helped me develop my own Jewish identity in a way that was very contrasting to what I'd been taught beforehand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that kind of connection between Yiddishkeit and Buddhism or leftist politics is something that in the modern day, some people see as kind of distanced. But it was when I started seriously learning Yiddish and engaging in kind of modern Yiddishkeit through the Steiner program, and then later in Berlin through Berlin Yiddishkeit, like Schmusenwein, which is the conversation circle started by Jake Schneider and Shtetl Berlin, that I started running into people who in the modern day were interested in Bundist politics, who were interested in these ideas. And it was in no small part because it was one of the ways that they connected to the culture. And also because I think that Yiddish and Yiddish art in particular has always been a way that Jews who have felt deeply connected to, but also in some ways like outsiders from the Jewish community, have connected and found a home, whether it was queer Jews in the Klezmer revival or working class Jews.
If I may ask, would you recommend the Steiner program?
I absolutely would. For one thing, it's a lot cheaper than YIVO. We love YIVO, however. It's also, I think, a lot younger in its students, and that makes it a really exciting place to study as someone who is a college student and who is a little newer to the Yiddish world. You know, I love intergenerational conversations. I love talking with other Jews, but there's something really exciting about that kind of environment. But more so, I think the most important thing is just directly personally connecting with modern Yiddish culture in some way, because that world is so interconnected and it will open so many doors. In a similar way to kind of learning about the Bund, engaging with modern Yiddish subculture was the next thing in terms of Jewish leftist political development that really opened my eyes. And it also helped me find a Jewish community that I was a lot more comfortable with than sometimes synagogues, which I am relatively observant, but sometimes I felt like I was walking on edge around my practice or about my political opinions.
I think the availability of Yiddish as well, where you mentioned about YIVO, all of us loving YIVO all the time, with everything they do, as as may or may not be the case. But the availability of programs, and also not just the possibility of learning, because the thing about learning Yiddish or any other language is that anyone can really learn to some extent or another on their own. But it's not going to really create that sort of communal interactions that is necessary for language, ultimately, as a means of communication. And so the efforts, for example, the Schmoozkreis that has been organized in Berlin, similar efforts like the Yiddish Open Mic Cafe in Britain, what's happening right now in Vienna with Jung Yiddish Wien, I think these are all very good developments, and ones that certainly there needs to be some sort of political force that, if not stands completely behind them, at least one that is supportive of them. And not just of Yiddish, but also of other languages, diasporic languages that are not supported. You know, Ladino comes to mind, Bukhari comes to mind, and so on.
For anyone who might not know, YIVO is the main Yiddish scientific institute, which is largely based in New York. I believe they also have offices in Lithuania, if I'm correct.
It was founded in Vilna.
YIVO plays a very important role as an archive more than anything else, which is really important as historians. We need that to engage with the materials they have. But of course, you also do need the education to learn the language, because so many people treat Yiddish as if it is a dead language, when it's arguably the most living Jewish diasporic language that exists today, because Hebrew has become the monolithic language for Jewish culture in a lot of ways. Zionism has really flattened Judaism into this monolithic nationalism, which has reduced the educational opportunities for a lot of other Jewish languages like Yiddish.
Yeah, I grew up going to this liberal Zionist reform shul. I have an Ashkenazi family, and so sometimes at home I might say good Shabbos, but if I said that at shul, I might get corrected to, oh, that's bad Hebrew, you say Shabbat Shalom. It was one of those things where it was very progressive around my queerness, and it talked a lot about Tikkun Olam, but it also did all of its charity fundraising events for Israel. So one of the magical things about coming to Steiner was seeing a really alternative way of imagining Jewish communal spaces, where it wasn't just synagogue, it wasn't just a single issue activism space, which is of course also important, but it was this space where people who were interested in Yiddish for all sorts of reasons were coming together and talking about that and making art. There were people who were there because they did klezmer music. My RA does Yiddish puppet theater, and people who were there like me because they were Bundists. And having all of that in one place and seeing this kind of countercultural alternative style of doing Judaism was a really incredible experience. And then I stayed in touch with all of those people, and they put me in touch with more people. And it was like I was seeing a whole other side of the Jewish community to anything that I'd seen in my campus Hillel or in my synagogue or even in my family.
I mean, I honestly didn't connect to Yiddish culture at all until going to Poland with Zach last year. I was like vaguely aware of Yiddish, pretty much believed it was a dead language, and they didn't really acknowledge its existence in my synagogue at all. It was Hebrew, Hebrew, Hebrew. There was one Ladino song that they would sing on Hanukkah you might be able to guess it, Ochos Candelas. It's so cheesy. And it felt largely just kind of like pandering to the fact that there are other Jewish languages than anything else. But there wasn't any Yiddish singing. And there was one online Yiddish event that my synagogue hosted with someone from the Yiddish Book Center, which I believe does a standard program. But enough on Yiddish. I think it's important to recognize that it is a very big way to engage with Jewishness outside of the religious context, which is often the way it's reduced, or a national context in the way that Zionism reduces Jewishness. But it's also important to recognize that there's many, many Jewish languages, and that while many of us, all of us here, are Ashkenazi, there are other Jewish communities. We just covered Sephardic in a way. And it's important to not fall into the trap of Ashkenormativity, because Judaism is so pluralistic as a people, as a culture. But I did want to transition towards student politics, because you said you're going to Berkeley mainly, and now you're in Berlin. And it's hard to talk about Berkeley without acknowledging the protests that have been going on recently, whether it's the encampment or the demonstrations during graduation that have made quite a scene lately. It's something that is part of a much wider movement across the US and around the world. And I was kind of wondering how your experience both at Berkeley and in Berlin around student politics have differed from each other, and what similarities you might see across these two very different contexts.
So Berkeley and Freie Universität, my university in Berlin, are both universities that in their respective countries are kind of known as the radical lefty school, in large part because of free speech movements during the 1970s and demonstrations against the Vietnam War. This is true for Freie Universität as well. And I think at Berkeley, that is partly still true that there is the student activism culture, but it's also true that with the increasing privatization of the university and the growth of the business school and the computer science department, it's different than it used to be. And we see a lot the university kind of trying to capitalize on this legacy, whether it's selling merch related to the free speech movement or naming buildings after them, and then not respecting the student protest movements of the modern day, as we're seeing. I think the student advocacy going on there now, though, is really big and really exciting. And it's been a really lively place to be politically involved, where there is a lot of student organizing. I was involved in restarting the Jewish Voice for Peace chapter at Berkeley. There had been one before, and there was already a lot of organic energy around that issue. I was involved in the Young Democratic Socialists of America chapter, and we were especially involved when a year or so ago, there was the largest academic workers strike in US history, I believe, when the entirety of the UC system had their student workers go on strike. So there's definitely been a lot of organizing. And fortunately, the demonstrations there in terms of the encampment so far has been relatively peaceful in terms of police violence against protesters, of course, not completely. And I think it's also important to recognize the efforts of especially state schools and the CSUs, where there's also really amazing organizing going on, and in some cases, quite a lot of violence, but that don't get a lot of recognition because they're not Ivy Leagues or these famous schools. And then at Freie, we are seeing a lot of violence in contrast, which has been really striking to me coming from Berkeley, is just, wow, Germany right now is a totally different organizing environment. Everyone I'm talking to is saying, oh yeah, I got beat up by the police 3 times in the last couple months alone. And just earlier this past week, we had a student Palestine encampment that after a couple hours was violently put down by police. Protesters were physically injured and removed from the campus. And so seeing that has been a really radicalizing experience than knowing that's happening intellectually at other schools.
Yeah, I mean, my brother is at UCLA as a TA. And because he's a grad student worker, I guess, he didn't really feel like he was able to take part in the encampment there as much as he'd have liked to, because just the fear of job security is a real thing. But when you speak to violence against protesters, there was a lot of that there, whether it was from the state or from outside Zionist groups that were effectively supported by the state. One thing my brother told me was that there was a jumbotron brought in by these outside Zionist groups, a giant TV screen with speakers, and they were playing clips from October 7th. And this went on for 5 days, effectively psychological warfare against the encampment.
Nasty.
And when they finally did the so-called sweep of the encampment, when they finally cracked down and shut down the encampment, the state troopers, I don't know who actually did it, I think it might have been the police, they did not touch the jumbotron. They actually protected it and let it get recovered by the people that brought it there, which shows that this is state-sanctioned psychological warfare against students, which is wild that we're seeing that. And I can only imagine how much worse it is in Germany.
Yeah. In Germany, it is, for example, illegal to, at a demonstration, say from the river to the sea. You will be arrested. And sometimes for posting it on social media, you can get your house searched. You can get police asking questions to your neighbors. People have been getting letters, for example, around May 1st, telling them not to try anything. And it's really, really scary. You know, I'm used to being involved in civil disobedience actions. I'm a white, upper middle class kid from California. I have not been the one on the receiving end of police violence when it's happened. I've known intellectually about it, but seeing it happening on the scale to students at my campus and not really feeling like I'm able to get involved because I am not a German citizen and I would get sent home. And of course, there are people who are not citizens who are putting themselves at risk right now, who I have a huge amount of respect for. It's really scary and it's a whole different kind of powerlessness. And because it's really so arbitrary what the police here will arrest people over and because things can turn violent so fast in terms of police response and it's never predictable where that will happen, it feels like there isn't any form of safe political protest that you can trust to say, oh, this is definitely not an arrestable action. This is definitely an event you can take your kids to. This is definitely safe because no form of protest right now really feels safe here. There was a protest encampment in front of the Reichstag in April, and before they cleared it, there was a foreign languages ban in the camp because people might be saying illegal phrases in other languages. And that included Arabic, but also included Irish Gaelic. It included Hebrew and Yiddish. And that meant that, this being April, when the Jews in the camp tried to hold a Passover Seder, they had to risk arrest because, of course, a Passover Seder requires you to speak Hebrew and or Yiddish. And so you had a situation where people were risking arrest at the hands of German police in order to hold a Pesach Seder in the name of protecting Jews from anti-Semitism.
That's pretty gross, and I definitely want us to come back to the context of Germany and delve more into this. But I also wanted to bring up Berkeley again, because Berkeley does have this long history of protest culture. And it's also very interesting that you're going to be doing with your research, focusing on the relationship and differences between national cultural autonomy and third world decolonial nationalism. It's very interesting that you're doing that at Berkeley, because the big protest movements in the 60s in Berkeley, one of them was the Third World Liberation Front, where you had what ended up creating the first ethnic studies department, where you had huge protests and strikes and mass movement to make sure that there was substantial coverage of the third world and non-white cultures in the university. So I'm very interested to see how your studies and focus and research on this topic is being shaped by this generation of previous mass protest, which was not around Palestine necessarily, but was around anti-colonial movements all over the world.
And it's definitely been a really interesting organizing environment as well, in part because a lot of the people who were involved in those movements or whose advisors were involved with those movements are now professors at UC Berkeley. And some of those people are the ones who are showing up to our Palestine teach-ins. And it's amazing when you have Usama Makdisi and Angela Davis speaking up for students, but it's also a really scary time in the ethnic studies department. We had a teacher and his TAs get doxxed because he requested that students go and observe some of the protests that were happening early on because they were talking about exactly the kinds of protest movements that we're seeing right now. And so it's kind of striking to be in an environment where there's so many of these incredible thinkers, some of whom I agree with, some of whom I don't, but who have undoubtedly contributed an immense amount to left-wing political movements in the United States, standing up for students and theoretically being lauded by the university as a part of their academic history as well as their campus culture. But then also seeing those same teachers be put in a very dangerous situation by the university, get doxxed publicly with very little consequences.
I just want to ask one more question on that, which is, have you been in touch with people involved at the Berkeley encampment? I'd just be very curious to hear how you've been personally connected to that movement.
Yeah, so I mentioned I was involved in the Young Democratic Socialists of America and Jewish Voice for Peace. Both of those groups have been showing up to the encampment, have been providing support, and so I've been in conversation with my friends back home. And one of the hardest parts about being here is not being able to support them. But there have been some incredible moments. Like, I remember seeing photos of the Cal Jewish Voice for Peace Pesach Seder on the encampment, and then seeing all the messages back and forth about, did you remember to get maror and all of this stuff. But then also those terrifying moments where it's like, there's someone who we're pretty sure is an undercover cop hanging around. Oh, you know, there was this interaction with a counter-protester. I would say there's a lot of energy and a lot of commitment.
I was gonna ask one last question on this point, which is, has your relationship to the encampment movement in the United States, I mean, I'm in Santa Cruz, we've had a very peaceful and really beautiful encampment in UCSC going on that started on May Day. Has this movement impacted or informed the sort of activism and organizing you've been doing where you are? And how has that manifested?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for one thing, in a very direct way, I mentioned that there was a large student encampment at the university that I am attending. And even though I was not personally involved in that action, because it was very clear that everyone was going to be arrested, I remember standing across the street and seeing these armored police vehicles roll up and checking people's IDs as they went to class and dragging people away. And that was terrifying and made me think about my friends in the United States at the encampment. But also, it was really cool to see this kind of international advocacy. And even here, where there is so much repression, people are still taking inspiration and still doing this. And of course, there were some encampments in Germany. Earlier, I mentioned the encampment in front of the Reichstag, which was not specifically a student one. But I think it's definitely given me hope about the level of commitment in the student movement. You know, I mentioned that Berkeley, the culture today in student organizing doesn't feel the same as it probably did in the 60s or the 70s. And so it does give me a lot of hope to see these kind of movements popping up there again and across the country and at all of these different schools. It does give me hope for the future of radical student organizing, even as it scares the shit out of me in terms of the type of response that we're seeing. Things had already been quite escalated on this issue beforehand, even well before the encampments. You know, after October 7th, we had a truck come by our university with screens, and they had a big projection of Hitler. And there were also, even in the like Jewish student organization Hillel chats, there were a lot of terrified messages, of course, because there's a truck driving around campus with Hitler on it. It turned out it was there to compare pro-Palestine protesters to the Nazis. Even before October 7th, we'd had an incident where a lot of law school students were docked because of a student organization's decision not to host Zionist speakers. And there have been attempts to get photos of people in Jewish Voice for Peace and to dox them. And so it was already at this very tense place. And I'm sure that right now things are even crazier. I mean, I can't imagine being a Palestinian on campus right now, but I've also never seen this much support for Palestine and kind of this level of activism at my university, aside from maybe some of the strikes. So it's really incredible to see.
I haven't been too active in the encampment at Oxford. I've been visiting there maybe once or twice a day since it was set up, now that we're recording this on the 14th last week. And for the time being here, it seems to be relatively calm. There was one incident where some taxi full of lads came and started doing some shouting, escalating. They even included like shouting things like fake Jew at people, which seems strange. But what's also been good is that it has been relatively calm presence, and we'll see when it comes to the future of the encampment and the university gaining attention and sort of gaining the demands. These things can radically change. Before we sort of dive into more on Germany, because there is a lot of, the German context is quite specific, it's worth analysing it in detail, and we haven't really done anything about Germany yet. But I just wanted to ask one final point that keeps us at Berkeley in this conversation. You mentioned Hillel once or twice, and we've had some people here that have been engaged with Hillel to some extent or another. I guess I'm involved with Hillel a little bit because the Union of Jewish Students is sort of merged with it in Britain. When you pay for a Friday night dinner through the UJS website, the money goes to the B'nai B'rit Hillel Foundation. But the dynamics are very different in terms of leadership and accountability. So if I may just ask, what has your experience been like with the Hillel organization at Berkeley and sort of what is considered to be the mainstream Jewish community?
Yeah, so when I first came to university, one of the first ways that I got involved with Jewish student life was through the Hillel, because it is where the Jewish community on the campus is, or at least where it was. And for a while, like, I knew it was a Zionist organization, at least in theory. You know, I walked past a big Israeli flag in the lobby every day. At the same time, I was very open about being an anti-Zionist there. I did not give them money. And I really valued being able to participate in that community. My rabbi was a Yiddishist. She actually held this class when the strike happened on Jewish workers throughout history. And she cited the Bund in that source sheet along with all these verses from the Talmud. And I was able to do a lot of organizing within there, whether it was ranting to people about the Bund at the Shabbos table or connecting with different queer Jews along that axis. And so it was a place where I and literally like hundreds of other Jews at my university, because UC Berkeley is a very big school with a big Jewish community, found a place where we were able to kind of develop our Jewish practice and get together. It's where most of the Jewish student orgs were run through, whether that was the Queer Jewish Organization, whether that was these Zionist student groups, whether it was a feminist Jewish student group. Basically, anything was run through the Hillel, because that was the university recognized Jewish Student Association. I was very involved to the point where I was doing a leadership fellowship with them. I was thinking about running for Hillel Student Board, or applying, I should say, because Hillel does not have elected leadership. And then October 7th happened, and I was suddenly aware that everyone at the Hillel knew that I was an anti-Zionist. And I was aware of that because one night when I was walking home from a JVP Shabbos, I ran into a couple of Zionists tearing down posters that were pro-Palestine. I was wearing my kippah and holding my Yiddish books in her bag. And so one of them saw me and went, "Oh, support Israel, stand with Israel." I kept walking. The other girl was from Bears for Israel, the UC Berkeley main Zionist organization. And she recognized me specifically from the Hillel. And she yelled, "That fucker does not stand with Israel, self-hating Jew." And this was about 11 o'clock at night. I was alone. I kept walking, but it was a bit of an intimidating experience, especially when a couple days later I found out that there had been an attempt to dox me. And so Hillel was suddenly a place where I no longer felt physically safe going to Shabbos, especially because I knew this kind of behavior was tolerated there. Well before October 7th, there had been a J Street event. J Street is an organization that is Zionist but supports a two-state solution and is in some Jewish spaces one of the more critical groups on Israel. And they had hosted an event with Breaking the Silence, which is an organization of former Israeli soldiers who were disturbed by some of the things they saw in their service and talk about it. During this event, these soldiers were talking about some of the atrocities that they were forced to be party to, that they chose to be party to, that they witnessed. And the Zionist group had chosen to come to the event, sit in half the room, heckle all of the speakers throughout their presentation, yelling all kinds of things, calling it lies, and then they stormed out as a group. And this was completely allowed by the Hillel leadership. There were very few consequences. I think the group that did that technically disaffiliated, but they just went over to the Chabad. And all of them still showed up at Shabbos dinner every night. So that was a really clarifying moment in terms of, I know how much effort it took to get this J Street Breaking the Silence event to happen in the first place. There were so many meetings behind closed doors and so many arguments, and it was very narrowly allowed. And then this kind of disruption and action was just tolerated by Hillel leadership. And so it made it very clear that this is not a place that is safe to be if you're critical of Israel. And they might not kick you out for being anti-Zionist, but they won't do anything about the people there who make it unsafe for you. And I stayed in Hillel for a while, for so long, until I was essentially forced out, because I still felt like this is the culture in the institution, but maybe we can change that. I even know people who are anti-Zionists who did end up on the Hillel student board and were able to moderate some of the stances they took. But at the end of the day, Hillel is a Zionist organization and its national policies forbid them, for example, funding an anti-Zionist student group in the same way that they would a Zionist student group. And so Hillel can never host an anti-Zionist student group. They have this purpose-locked funding for certain Zionist initiatives, and there is no elected body of students. The student board is appointed. And even then, the student board doesn't have all that much power. They can put out a statement, but then there's also going to be the official Hillel statement from the paid staff who are employees of the company, who in some cases, I know because I've seen it happen, will be fired for expressing anti-Zionist opinions. And so that made me really feel like, okay, we've seen the Open Hillel movement tried to really push Hillel on these policies at a national level. And in the end, they were forced to revert to those Zionist policies or disaffiliate. So maybe what we need to do is build Jewish community that will be an alternative to Hillel so that it's not the only site of Jewish organizing on campus, and to kind of fill that niche.
Thank you for all that. I do want to add in, the UCSC encampment's been getting a lot of flack recently because they put out a demand for the university to boycott Hillel. Some people have been like, oh, this is anti-Semitism. I'm looking at some articles right now. There's a New York Post article that specifically said that Jewish groups are claiming that as anti-Semitism. And I think it's important to stress that it's not anti-Semitism. The only reason Hillel's being targeted for boycott is because, as you said, it is explicitly a Zionist organization. It very clearly ties Judaism and Zionism together and effectively will not allow people to speak against that. I mean, your experience really speaks to the way that, like, even if you're not officially not allowed to participate in their events, you're socially ostracized, you're intimidated by people, you're put in a position where expressing these opinions will effectively alienate you from the community, so you might as well be explicitly not allowed to attend. And it's important to say that it's not anti-Semitic to be against Hillel. We actually did a conversation that we ended up taking down because of some specific stuff. That was like a 20-minute conversation. I think maybe we should re-upload it on its own, that was about this specifically, because Hillel has so many problems. I think you're absolutely right. We do need to challenge the monopoly that Hillel has on Jewish community organizing. Even if that monopoly isn't really a monopoly and there are alternatives, it is the one that does get the most mainstream support and mainstream attention as a nonpartisan Jewish organization and community.
I think there's a lot to discuss furthermore about Hillel, and specifically, if we try and envisage our institutions to be communal, democratic, and sort of try and build some sort of local national cultural autonomy of some kind, then the question of building new spaces or contesting spaces is a discussion that really depends on the context and also the individual capacities and security of organizers and members of the communities. I mean, the kind of disgraceful behavior that we see from Hillel's and even, I would say, sometimes local JSOCs in Britain really does do a lot of bad to students, despite, you know, the inclusivity that the leaderships of these organizations like to tout a lot of the time. And the response to that, I think, can be multi-pronged, multifaceted.
The one last thing that I wanted to mention about Hillel is that I do think that a lot of people like me who do not think of themselves as Zionists do go to Hillel just because it's where Jewish community is and it's where they can find that. And I understand why people get freaked out when they see people saying, especially when they don't have a lot of context for it, Hillel is Zionist, we need to get rid of it immediately. You know, I got an email from that rabbi I mentioned who included the Bund in a Judaism and workers' rights class just the other week, being like, oh, I saw your photo at the Krakow May Day parade. I know you haven't felt like you can come to Hillel, but just kind of checking in. And that was really sweet. And I think that there are a lot of individuals who are even institutionally involved with Hillel, let alone just go there, who are legitimately well-intentioned and who go there because they want to be a part of shaping Jewish communal life. But the problem is that within an institutional framework that only allows certain voices, just like any other institutional framework, just like capitalism, right? It's not that everyone that participates in it is evil or has this ill intent, but as long as the structure remains the way that it does, you cannot entirely be supportive of the whole Jewish community on campus. You cannot behave in an ethical way. And so that's why the fundamental structure needs to change.
Yeah, I might add as well, there's a person involved as one of the organizers, the directors, I believe, of the UCSC Hillel, and I've been told she's effectively non-Zionist. She's not very ideological at all, but she still refused to even go down to the encampment and check it out and listen to what these people are saying, instead of just kind of embracing the caricatured view that is so prevalent in mainstream media and by Hillel as an organization.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the time I feel sort of uncomfortable trying to hold individual students to account in relation to general organizations and systems we're talking about as a whole. Although from time to time it doesn't hurt, and I'll just use this opportunity again to mention that the Union of Jewish Students president knows me, as my contact. I've invited him onto the podcast to speak and discuss at some point, and he's never felt up to it for a kind of discussion about this sort of stuff. I would be nice, but there's also important things relating to inclusivity and how we imagine Jewish communal life to be that would be important to mention. We don't have too much time left, so I want to go back across the Atlantic. We've mentioned, you know, quite a bit about the situation of Berlin and the movement as a whole. I think something that's important for us to think about here is, you know, what can we do to change it and build on it? So we've heard about some organizations relating to the situation of the Jewish left, and perhaps this might be more specific to Berlin, but if there is the situation in, I don't know, for example, Munich or in the Rhineland or Hamburg, what is the Jewish left political landscape and organizing that's been going on? How do these organizations relate to each other? You don't have to go into any sort of like tea, if you want, especially as a participant. This isn't the drama podcast, but we would like to have some sort of idea of if there are people who are interested who are listening in from Germany. We do have listeners in Germany. Grüß Gott. That's probably not the right thing to say. Guten Abend. Maybe you'll be able to direct them. What different organizations are at play? Who is organizing in these spaces?
Yeah, so I do want to just give a disclaimer that, especially because, as mentioned, I have to be very careful with my organizing as an international student, and also because I'm relatively new to organizing here, I am not the most front lines in deep organizer in Germany, and so I might not be able to give as full a picture. I apologize to our German listeners if I'm not comprehensive. As many Germans will tell you, Berlin is also basically a different country from the rest of Germany. And so not everything might be broadly applicable, although we have seen other student occupations at other universities in Germany, I believe, not just in Berlin. So one of the big Jewish anti-Zionist organizations in Germany is Jüdische Stimme, or Jewish Voice. They are probably the biggest Jewish anti-Zionist organization in Germany, and they recently had their bank account frozen by the German government when they were trying to help facilitate the Palestina Congress in Berlin, which was a gathering of a lot of different anti-Zionist speakers and groups. And when they did eventually try to hold the conference, it was very brutally put down by police. They are an interesting group, and they were the first one that I came into contact with because in one of my first days in Germany, I completely by accident stumbled into a demonstration that was pro-Palestine, and I started marching with them.
As one does.
And I was wearing a Magen David, and this older lady walked up to me and started speaking to me very excitedly in German. And my German is okay, it's not great, but we got through it. She speaks amazing English. And she was from Jüdische Stimme, and they pretty much immediately welcomed me into that. And so they've been doing a lot of work in Berlin. One interesting thing is that a large part of their membership is Israeli expats who tend to be more on the secular side of things. And so when I was first joining, I asked, okay, one of the things that JVP does, for example, back at UC Berkeley is host Kabbalat Shabbat as an alternative to the sometimes very Zionist mainstream Jewish community. Is there any kind of alternative practicing Jewish space? And the answer was largely, oh, some of the other American expats here are organizing that kind of thing, but it was something that they hadn't been doing as much, in part because to a lot of the kind of secular Israelis, that kind of Jewish religious practice was very much associated with the right. And so that was kind of an interesting dynamic within that group that was a little bit different. They've been doing some amazing work. Definitely check them out. The Jewish Anti-Fascist Bund is another organization. They are Bund-inspired, although I would not directly say that they are Bundist. If you are interested specifically in Jewish Palestine organizing, they've been doing a lot of work. And then also, there are pro-Palestine student organizations. I want to make sure that I'm getting the name right, but there's the Students for Palestine, FU, at my university, and similar ones at the other big universities like Humboldt. Of course, there are many, many Palestinian and left organizations broadly. But also, I think that there are a lot of kind of more isolated, smaller efforts or individuals within different spaces who have not been connected yet. For example, I have been going to synagogue regularly when I'm in Berlin, and I broadly go to a very Zionist shul. But when I stayed afterwards at Kiddush and I brought up, hey, that drash was a little bit Zionist, I suddenly found a lot of people who agreed. And I found out that those conversations had already been happening, especially among young people at different synagogues, among people who weren't necessarily connected with especially the more secular kind of non-institutional Jewish anti-Zionist organizations, but were interested in Palestine organizings. At the Seder of a woman who I met at synagogue, I met her son, who, as it turned out, had written most of the Boone's Wikipedia page. And so there's a lot of work to be done, I think, that is very possible and very important in connecting activism and momentum within Jewish institutional spaces with these organizations that exist outside of Jewish institutional spaces.
Definitely. I did have one little question I wanted to ask purely from like a diasporist perspective. What language is mostly being spoken here? Because we mentioned like a little bit of a divide between the American expats and what you could call the native German Jewish community there. What language is being spoken, and is there any obstacle? Is there any language barrier posed by that?
I would say there definitely is some Yiddish as a site of organizing, for one thing. I met some incredible organizers who have been very active at Shtetl Berlin, which is a Berlin-based, specifically Neukölln Yiddish festival. And especially with the kinds of language bans we've been seeing at protests, there have been some interesting conversations happening about the role of language in protest. In Yiddish Stimme, I mentioned there's a lot of Israeli expats, so there's a lot of Hebrew speakers, but more often the language of conversation is German or English. And I think as an expat, honestly, the Jewish organizations have been a little bit more accessible as an English speaker because there are Jews coming from all over the place and we do speak a lot of different languages. And so the people involved in that activist community, I mean, in Berlin, most people really speak English, but have been doing that more in terms of the language that events are hosted in. At Shul, people mostly speak German, unless, for example, at the Shul I attend, we sometimes get visitors who want to see what does the post-Holocaust Jewish community in Germany look like, especially being in a Berlin synagogue. And so people will speak English with them, or sometimes Ukrainian. There are a lot of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants right now. But then if you stick around in the community and you hang out at Kiddush, people are talking in German. So I guess more concisely, there's actually a variety of languages that are involved in organizing. And sometimes that is very politicized because of the focus and the crackdowns on language from the government. And some of it is an organic product of a lot of the people involved in Jewish organizing and Jewish anti-Zionist organizing in Germany are coming from a lot of different backgrounds, whether it's refugees from Ukraine, whether it's Israeli expats, whether it's people like me who are just passing through and studying in Berlin, whether it's people who have been living in Germany their entire lives. And so really, people adapt the language to the context that they're in. And in Shul, it's more German or sometimes Yiddish. There are a lot more native Yiddish speakers I've encountered here than in San Francisco. But yeah.
It's interesting to see all these developments happening in Germany and Berlin with the demonstrations and the general climate within Germany that, in my view, is quite performative in terms of trying to present yourself as, you know, having gone past all of the history of the Holocaust. And now it's just like the whole question about anti-Semitism commissioners, and Felix Klein does a good piece about it in Jewish Currents and some responses to how that's been treated, trying to demonstrate anti-Semitism as this thing that has been dealt with in Germany, but now is being brought back because the immigrants, the brown people, have brought it back and they are the scary ones that we have to take care of and therefore clamp down on all sorts of Palestine solidarity efforts. And if there are some Jews or Israelis in there, well, they don't really count. No pun intended to the reference to the book by David Baddiel. But I think it is a bit worrying from my perspective that there is a lot of pressure and emphasis from people who are involved in Palestine solidarity organizing, many of whom are Israeli anti-Zionists. We know about the big Israeli diaspora in Germany and Berlin, but it does seem to be quite performative in just opposition to it and not trying to really build on some sort of positive vision. It's a bit like banging against a brick wall, in my outsider opinion, that, you know, people are getting arrested many times. There are severe repressions that are happening against the state, and the question of strategy and tactics and trying to develop something and engagement with the German Jewish community, not just in Berlin as well. The German Jewish community is one of the largest ones in the world, and it has its own specific interesting aspects because the majority of German Jews came from the former Soviet Union in the 80s and 1990s. And from some conversations interest I've had there, the socioeconomic dynamics are interesting. The question of being immigrants and not being the sort of established middle class as many Western Jews Jewish communities like to portray themselves as like having surpassed that moment of the American dream or integration into polite society. It is interesting to think about that. And also something that comes to mind about the very specific dynamics that you have in play in Germany, that you have this relatively strong current within the radical left that is anti-German. For those who don't know about the Anti-Deutsche, the idea of people like supporting the bombing of Dresden again or standing with Israel because anything that is associated with Germanness is bad and therefore anything that is opposite to that is good. It's given me this kind of sitcom idea of an Israeli anti-Zionist meeting up with a German anti-German sort of buddy cop dynamic between the two. But then in all seriousness to what's been going on there, there have been cases of like German non-Jews harassing Israeli anti-Zionist Jews, which is very strange to think about in any context outside of Germany. But then it's also worth remembering that what happens in Germany and decisions that the German government does, aside from like things relating to recognition of the state of Palestine, which is coming on the agenda in many European Union countries, but also the fact that decisions that Germany makes relating to specific activists, so for example, Dr. Hassan Abu Sitta, who's been banned from Germany, has also been therefore banned from France and coming to speak in France not too long ago. These things have a strong impact. And so I will just end my little spiel on this. It's a question of having some sort of positive vision and also connecting between these borders, because Germany, Berlin, they're not that far away from either Poland or the Czech Republic or even France. And so it's not so much the case that we can't try and break down these borders in a very much diasporist mechanic and view and connect what some might perceive, especially if you look at it from the American perspective, as small Jewish communities. So for the final points relating to Germany, I'm also serving up one of the times that we met a few weeks ago in Krakow. So Zalman, for someone who recently traveled to Poland for the first time and is able to connect in the same way that Ben was when he came, or in a similar way, would you like to say a little bit about that and sort of finalize your remarks around Germany as well?
Yeah, for sure. So first of all, I just wanted to say, lastly on Germany, I totally agree with what you're saying about the need for a positive vision. And I think that especially because there is this split on the German left between the Anti-Deutsche and the anti-imperialism. Recently, About Blank, which is this famous Anti-Deutsche club in Berlin, had an anti-Semitism panel. Originally, there were going to be no Jews on it.
Who needs them?
Yeah, exactly. Who needs them? And then I think they kind of added one at the last minute, but that's been a large site of contention. And then you do have, even within organizations I really respect, who I think are overall doing great work, there will sometimes be positions or statements that I am really uncomfortable with. Also, I mentioned the institutional Jewish spaces and the Jewish left are very divided from each other. That's why I think a lot of the most important work that needs to be done in Germany right now is in connecting those spaces, because there are people who are at Schul who are looking for something. There are people out on the streets who have been alienated by those communities who would love a way back. And so I encourage you, if you are in Germany, to go to your local shul. I know it's hard. I had to leave Hillel because of harassment from Zionists there. But I think that you will also find more than you expect if you're willing to kind of take that plunge. And on the flip side, if you are very involved with the German Jewish community, but you have not gone to any of these Palestine events because some of the rhetoric can be a little extreme or a little scary, I think that you should try and go to a demo, go to something a little more chill. There are all kinds of other events that happen, whether they're panels or screenings, and talk to some people and you might be surprised at what you find. So I don't mean to moralize as someone who got here a few months ago, but there is so much amazing work happening all over the place and so much momentum. And I think that if a bridge can be built there, which I really think it can, you could see some amazing results. So yeah, I was recently in Poland. I had the opportunity to go and be part of the Krakow Jewish May Day block, which Zach may have had something to do with, I guess. And it was one of the most incredible organizing experiences that I have had in my life. For one thing, because there were so many Jews there from all of these different communities in Central and Eastern Europe, whether it was people from the Czech Republic, whether it was people from Latvia or locals from Poland. And we all had these kind of different conversations about what Jewish organizing, what anti-Zionist organizing, what socialist organizing, and what building a positive vision looked like in these different contexts and the struggles that we shared and the struggles that were different. And having those kinds of conversations opened up so many possibilities and also taught me so much. And so it was amazing personally and to sing Die Shvua with a bunch of Bundists. But also, more importantly than that, we got so many very kind messages afterwards from people who were not Jewish but were involved with the May Day rally, and particularly Palestinian organizers who were moved by seeing a Jewish bloc in solidarity with them. And so it really drove home that that organizing does have an impact, and especially in contexts where there are these divides. Really, any step can have a big impact on the shape of the movement and the tone of discussions as a whole. So there's a lot I could say about Krakow, you know, marching past the old headquarters of the Galician Social Democratic Party, aka the Bund. But more broadly, I think that seeing that kind of connection between different kind of Jewish communities and with the broader left was a window into what Jewish organizing in Europe, but also throughout the diaspora, can look like.
I do think the context of Germany and Poland, to a lesser extent, is instructional on both the dangers of not doing this and what you just said, the potentials and hope of doing this organizing, because especially in a place like Germany, where it is illegal to be anti-Semitic, but at the same time, we increasingly see the reliance upon the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which I encourage anyone who doesn't know what this is to look it up. It's very dangerous. It is being largely used to conflate anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. The opposite of that is that Zionism and Judaism are understood as the same thing. And as you mentioned, like, there was an anti-Semitism panel without any Jews on it. That's really telling about the way in which conversations about anti-Semitism can be taken away from our own community and effectively be used for the state's own ends. Because if anti-Semitism is adopted into this framework of the IHRA definition, then they can claim, as you were saying earlier, that Jews protesting in support of Palestinian liberation is anti-Semitic. And that completely, it's ridiculous to claim that Jews can be anti-Semitic in that way. I mean, when I was in Palestine last year, I had some random Israeli come up to me and tell me that I was a traitor to my people. It's something that I think most anti-Zionist Jews have experienced in their lives. It can be painful. But at the same time, having a Jewish block at Palestine protests, at a May Day rally, and being very clear that we are Jews standing in support of Palestinian liberation and the freedom of all peoples has a huge impact on undermining the ability to do that in the first place. And in a place like Germany or in Poland, where there's just not as many Jews as there are here in the United States, it can be very easy to effectively silence these other Jewish voices and to basically capitalize on our own experience in order to protect the state and ultimately reinforce these colonial paradigms that exist throughout the world. And it's very, very dangerous. So it's really incredible that you guys were able to do that in Poland. And I'm really envious that I couldn't be there this year. I'm glad I was able to help in a really roundabout way. There was one organizer who was there, and I was able to connect Zach with her through a friend of hers here in Santa Cruz. And that was a really weird diasporic experience.
True diasporism, connecting one person in Poland to another person in Poland via California. Yeah, the diasporism at work, ladies and gentlemen.
And I'm really glad I was able to do that. I believe she had written, I don't know if she wrote it actually, we'd love to have her on to talk more about it, but a Declaration of Independence for Diaspora that was spoken.
And no, that was the Czechs.
Oh, that was the Czechs that did it. But I just finally got a chance to read it, and it's really beautiful to think about how we as a people can have liberation outside of Zionism. And I really think, in light of the work that you're doing, Zalman, the way to understand liberation and national liberation, and specifically outside of a nationalist paradigm, is something that's really not spoken about a lot. And it's really important. If anything, I think it is the key contribution of the Jewish left to modern left-wing theory, that we can understand national liberation without calling for the establishment of another nation state. And that's something that is being wrestled with in the encampments around the globe. I was at a encampment in UCSC, and there was a teach-in going on, and that was something that the Palestinian professor who was talking was very clear about. Free Palestine doesn't just mean flipping Zionism on its head with the Palestinian ethnostate. It means something very different. And it's very hard for many people to really wrestle with the fact that words can mean different things to different people. But it's really important to really dig into these things and to think these through and to not just kind of take things at face value and your initial prejudices, your initial prejudgments of what someone means. Provide nuance and complicate the mainstream narratives that are only being used to divide people.
My final point is that in the case of Germany, a lot of the stuff relating to this discourse is not done for Jews. It's done by Germans for Germans. And this is also not something new in this context. I'd have to look more into it to be able to make my opinions more articulated. But my understanding is that a lot of the ways in which the West German government handled its relationship with Nazism and its sort of claim to atone for it, going back to 1950s and Konrad Adenauer's establishment of relations with Israel and what drove him in that way, had little to do with fighting anti-Semitism or building a world in which anti-Semitism does not exist. And that world certainly will not come with Germany being the second largest exporter of arms to the IDF after the United States. The two countries together make 99% of the exports to Israel. So onwards to that better future and onwards to building it together all over the place. Berlin, Berkeley, and anywhere in between and around. Thank you so much, Zalman. If there's anything else that you'd like to mention, you can do it here.
Thank you so much. There was just one more thing I wanted to say while we're on the topic of May Day, but also this broader fight for a positive vision, which is that one of the most amazing things about that May Day demonstration was seeing Jews organizing as Jews for labor rights, for our own security, and also alongside Palestinians. And so it really was this vision of, okay, this is not just a single issue, we're together as Jews because anti-Semitism is being weaponized thing, which is of course also important, but this is Jews organizing as Jews and being part of this broader movement that way. And I think that's really valuable, especially as we're talking about the reasons why a lot of Jews sometimes feel tempted towards the right when they talk about Israel and anti-Semitism is because one of the few times that anti-Semitism gets addressed is when we're talking about Israel. And I do think that it is important that we have those conversations outside of just that context as well. And the only way that we can do that is by having a positive, radical Jewish organization that does point out, hey, German government, if you want to fight anti-Semitism, here are some things you can do that would actually help our community and that can actually address those things while also fighting for Palestinian liberation and for workers everywhere and for the rights of people everywhere.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Zalman. I also was telling so many people that this was probably the most significant May Day in our lifetimes, if not generations, because this is the first time May Day has really been tied into anti-imperial struggles. And I think there's something really beautiful in that, to be able to understand that all of these issues are intertwined. You can't separate imperialism from capitalism. These are all connected. And it's really incredible that you guys were able to have a Jewish bloc in Krakow for the May Day march there. I'm really grateful that all of you could put that together and to show that Jews stand for justice no matter where we live. Thank you so much, Salman. Zu spreit zusammen, zusammen, die von sie ist greit. Sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut. A Schwue, a Schwue, a Fleb und Teut. Himmel und Erde wollen uns ois Herren, ey, das wird sein, die lichtige Stern. A Schwue vom Blut und a Schwue von Tränen, mir schwören, mir schwören, mir schwören. Mir schwören a Treuheit und Grenzen zum Bund, nur erkennbar freien, die Sklaven sind, die von die Reute ist heuch und breit. Sie flattert von Zorn, von Blut ist sie reut. A Schwue, a Schwue, a Fleb und Teut. Himmel und Erd wollen uns ois Herren, ey, das wird sein, die lichtige Stern.
mir schwer und trären, mir schweren, und na schwer und trären, mir schweren, mir schweren, mir schweren.